Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Carolyn Donaldson. Our guest today, Ron Haviv, is an Emmy-nominated, award-winning photojournalist and co-founder of the photo agency 7, which is dedicated to documenting conflict and raising awareness about human rights issues around the globe. In the last three decades, Ron's covered more than 25 conflicts and worked in over 100 countries. He's published four critically acclaimed collections of photography, and his work's been featured in numerous museums and galleries, including the Louvre, United Nations, and the Council on Foreign Relations. Ron Haviv, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure. Good to be here. Thank you.
Ron, you studied writing in college, and what led you to pursue this visual form of journalism, and what led to the subject matter that you've, of course, documented most, the conflict, war, and these horrific tragedies?
Well, I was a student at NYU, which is a very expensive school, and aside from my college loans, I was working a number of different jobs to help pay for school, and one of them by chance happened to be working for a fashion photographer. And as I was working for him on the lowest possible level of working, I was introduced to the world of photography. And to be honest with you, I don't know at what point or why I decided that I'd rather be a photographer than a writer, but at some point I said, oh, let's try this. And I took a basic introduction class to photography in my junior or senior year of school, and all of a sudden I was on my way.
You've said that every journalist has to have the ability to bond with people. So how do you bond with the subjects of your photographs?
Well, you know, sometimes a photographer only has a matter of seconds or moments to be able to create a very quick bond of trust, which is incredibly important to allow, for somebody to allow me as a photographer into their world is something very special and a relationship that I greatly appreciate. So I try to, whether sometimes it's not even with language, it might be a look, a gesture, or sometimes it is an actual conversation where you try to find similarities in your life and the subject's life to, in order for them to say that this person understands me and this person is not here to exploit me but to tell my story. And quite often, you know, most people in the world are not being documented. Their stories are not being told. And especially in places where there's political strife and where there's a reason for somebody's story to be told that might even be a matter of life and death, the photographer, the journalist, is that conduit to being able to bring that story to light. And today in the world, no matter where you are in any part of the world, people are sophisticated to know and understand the way that the media works and that they want their story to be told in more cases than not. And so using those sort of different things and the ability that I am there to, or the understanding that I'm there to do good, often allows me to have that quick relationship with someone.
You've also been quoted as saying a photojournalist's life's been framed by two important ideas, those of the bystander and the upstander. And more than once, you say those ideas have come into play at the most serious of times when someone's life is on the line, which you have documented over and over. And should you, can you, and when do you take the picture? And have you had to answer that question in your own work?
Unfortunately, this is something that I've had to have dealt with a number of times. It's something that comes up with many of us when we're put in these situations of what to do and what are your own rules. And there's really, it's a very personal decision for the journalist photographer on when to intervene and when not to. And so for me to try to help simplify it in my mind, it's pretty simple. If I'm the only person there that's able to help someone, bandage somebody up, take them to the hospital, perhaps even stop them from being executed or arrested without gravely putting my life in danger, I'll do so. If, however, there are other people there, to doctors or other people to protect them, then my job there is as your eyes and to document what's happening. And so sometimes the lines are blurred, and sometimes there are moments where it's pretty evident that the only thing I can do, if even that, is to document what's happening, to document the atrocity, because there's no way that I could stop it. And those are very, very difficult and unfortunate situations. But I try to make it sure, at least if I am in that situation, that there's evidence of what's happened. But there are many stories of not only myself, but many of us taking people to hospitals, driving refugees to safety, and so on. It's a mix. I don't think that, you know, this sort of impression often that people have that we've been likened to vultures, that we just go there to sort of prey on the unfortunate. And I don't think that that's a very good representation. But for sure, at times it could look like that. But in actuality, I think that the majority of people in these situations want to help with their photography, and if they're able to help with their actual physical presence.
Have you done things differently at different times in your life? Has some personal life experiences played into how you react when you're in those circumstances, Ron?
Well, I have unfortunately witnessed a number of people die in front of me, whether from famine or from being executed. And I've had a few opportunities to understand when I can step in and when I can't step in. And it's just going to be a case-by-case situation. I don't think there's any sort of, aside from the general rule I referenced, it is, you have to decide at a split moment what you're going to do and how you can help. And it is, we have some protection as often being the outsider, but that protection is becoming less and less. We've seen what's happened especially in Syria, James Foley, Marie Colvin, Remy Olchik, and many others who have been taken prisoner or who have been killed. It used to be that the camera and, of course, also the white skin and the representation of the Western world was this automatic kind of protection, and that no longer exists. All sides, all combatants, all governments understand the power of the media and understand, most importantly, the power of the image, and often are trying to control it, and sometimes through very deliberate and brutal means.
Speaking of that power of the image, you've been documented in so many ways, but what has been your best shot, and what has gotten some of your call to action as a result of that capturing of the image? I know you've got some specific examples in your books and throughout your work.
Well, there are a number of photographs that mean a lot to me that have had impact, but there really are probably two that have kind of sort of gone above and beyond. One is from Panama. It was taken in 1989, and it's a photograph of a post-election violence. And the story basically was there was a dictator named Noriega, who was holding elections to prove that he wasn't a dictator. He lost the elections, he nullified the results, and the would-be victors came onto the streets. And the photograph is of the vice president, who was supposed to be the vice president, covered in blood, being beaten up by a paramilitary supporter of the dictator. That photograph was on the cover of all three magazines in the United States and newspapers around the world. And had immediate impact. It was a big conversation. All of a sudden, Panama became a story, what's going on, how is the dictator treating his people, and so on, and gave the opposition movement a lot of courage to continue. But 7 months later, when the United States invaded Panama, President George Bush, who just recently passed, spoke about the photograph as one of the reasons for the invasion. It wasn't the only reason, but it was part of the conversation. And that, for me, this was my first foreign trip, my first experience of getting published in such a way. And I was still sort of trying to find my bearings as a photographer. And when I sort of came off the excitement of the success of having the covers and so on, when I heard the president speak about the photograph, I really understood that my role was to tell these stories. My role was to put the work out there so it could be part of a conversation so the next group of people could make decisions based on that. And so hearing the president speak about the photograph and connection to the invasion was incredibly powerful to me. And it wasn't whether I agreed with the invasion or not. It was just the understanding that my work played a role in that conversation. And then a few years later, I started working in Yugoslavia as that country disintegrated. And there was a series of wars that broke that country apart, and the war in Bosnia was the third war. And I wound up taking a photograph with some Serbian paramilitary groups and photographed them executing the first people to be executed in that conflict, middle-aged, unarmed men and women and wound up taking a photograph of a Serbian paramilitary who was in a very carefree way with a cigarette in one hand, sunglasses on his head, about to kick the bodies of people that had just been shot. And that photograph actually had no impact. There was no political reaction whatsoever to that photograph. And I started to see sort of the flip side of the limits of the power of photography. But as time went on, that photograph became more and more powerful and was eventually used in The Hague to indict and convict war criminals. And now both photographs are the subject of a documentary that I'm doing called Biography of a Photo. I'm co-directing it with Dr. Lauren Walsh, a professor of photography at NYU. And we're basically doing a biography looking at what happened to the photograph once it left the camera. And it's been fascinating to look at the life of each photograph, one 29 years later, the other one 26 years later, and see all the different impacts it had in terms of politics, foreign policy, propaganda, education, culture. It's been both photographs have been made into artworks and used in education and suppressed in education. All of these different things that the power of photography can have. And then what's even more interesting is, because I was always looking at the photographs, is their impact overall in a bigger way. But in reality, there's also a personal reaction and personal involvement to each photograph. So the vice president who's being beaten up by the paramilitary soldier is covered in blood. And the blood is from his bodyguard, who was killed protecting him. And the brother of the bodyguard feels like the government has never given his family any recognition for their sacrifice. He's using the photograph to galvanize support for recognition for his brother, and he wants there to be a statue in honor of his brother with a statue creation based on the photograph. So to this day, he's petitioning the government. So 29 years later, the photograph is still alive in Panama and recognizable by generations that are still living in Panama. The Bosnian photograph, the daughter of one of the victims, fled, became a refugee, raised her family in Austria, and once her children were grown, decided that even though she knew the photograph had had some impact with the war crimes tribunal, she wanted the three men in the photograph to be indicted for war crimes. So she is currently trying to get them indicted using the photograph as a sole piece of evidence. So we have these, and the film goes through this, looking at the bigger pictures of the effect of the photographs on policy, etc. But it's also these people's loved ones have become symbols of these atrocities, which is just very, for me as the photographer, incredibly fascinating to hear from them what they think about the photographs. So I think probably the best representation is that the daughter says that she hates the photograph. It's her mother lying there dying, so how could you not hate it? But at the same time, she's incredibly appreciative of the fact that there was this document and that it did have this impact and that her mother's life had some impact after her death.
So impactful. Thank you, Ron, for sharing that. We look at the length and the legs that those images have been in history and in policy, et cetera. But how has photojournalism changed now into today's Instagram and today's instant messaging and today's instant photos out there? And how has your work as a photojournalist changed in those same environs?
I think that there's a combination of two things that are happening in today's sort of world of overwhelming imagery. One is that it's very hard for people to even remember one photograph 3 or 4 hours later after they click or press like on Instagram, Facebook, etc. But at the same time, people are more interested in photography than ever before. And people are also taking photographs. So they're consumers of photography and they're producers of photography. So myself as a photographer, this is fantastic, that there's an audience. And so when photographs are able to sort of rise above photographs of journalistic importance, they're able to rise above the cat pictures and this is what I had for lunch and so on. The ability for it to have impact is incredible. And the ability to, quote unquote, go viral is more powerful now than ever. And we can look at a couple of photographs over the last few years, the photograph of Aylin Kurdi, the small Kurdish boy who unfortunately died trying to be a refugee on the beach. And that photograph actually had such impact that the Chancellor of Germany referenced it in changing her policy about refugees. In this country, we look at a photograph by John Moore of a child crying on the border and how that came into play in the conversation about family separation and immigration policies. So photography, even in this world of like bombarding image by image by image, they're saying I think more than 1 trillion images will be created in 2018, there is still the ability for work to rise above and to have impact. And so for myself, as one who is constantly trying to do that, it does without question give me hope that there is always the possibility and the room for photography to survive and thrive. Because many, many times, in fact, since I started as a photographer, I have been told photojournalism is dead, nobody cares about it, and I think time and time again that's proven wrong by the reception from the audience, that they do care about this kind of work.
Very interesting. Thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with award-winning photojournalist Ron Haviv. He's best known for covering wars and the effects of conflict. So let's continue now with your story of your first book, Blood and Honey, a Balkan War Journal, called one of the best nonfiction books of the year by the LA Times, a chilling but vastly important record of people's suffering by Newsweek. Your other books, Afghanistan, The Road to Kabul, Haiti, 12 January 2010, and your latest book, The Lost Roles. So let's focus on that. That was your topic of discussion here at Penn State recently. So why do you think Lost Roles and the Lost Roles Project is so important in today's world?
Well, Lost Roles very simply was that I had, over the course of 25 years, had put aside a roll of film here, a few rolls of film there, and never developed them. And wound up after the course of 25 years having several hundred rolls of film, of which I didn't really know what was on them. So I developed and processed this film and created this book called The Lost Roles. And what first started out as just like a fun thing to do actually wound up being this examination of the end of the analog era, where, and now that I shoot mostly digital, I always have information attached to an image. And here I had physical negatives and slides where often I didn't know where the photograph was taken, what year it was taken. And it kind of became this idea of looking at memory and the connection between memory and photography. And so it was a very interesting experience for myself to kind of look back at my career of images that I wasn't so familiar with, to see what I remembered, what meant, and how things meant, how it meant to me in a different time. Instead of looking at it in real time, I was looking at it 5, 10, 15, 20 years later and writing about that. And so when I gave the book tour and I went around from place to place and I would ask people in the audience, do you also have a roll of film sitting in a camera, sitting in a drawer, sitting in a box, maybe in your parents' house, film that was just never developed? All of a sudden, all the labs disappeared and most people don't know what to do with the film. And more than half the people would say, yes, we have no idea what to do with this film, or we forgot about it, or I don't really care about it. And or some people said, yeah, I moved and I threw away all my film that was undeveloped but exposed. And I realized, like, wow, people are, there are these little memories locked away in these canisters, and so maybe I can try to do something about it. So I went to Fujifilm and another company called PhotoShelter and another company called PhotoWings to join with the Seven Foundation to create this Lost Roles America project. And so Lauren Walsh, who the director of the film, is also working with me on this project. And basically what we're doing is we ask people to send in their film, and we'll process and scan it for free. And then we'll send you back a web link of the scans via PhotoShelter. And you choose one or two photographs that, not what the best photograph is, but what that photograph means to you in terms of your life. What memories does it bring back? What were you thinking at that time? What was happening to you at that time? And we're getting hundreds and hundreds of submissions. We've had several installation exhibitions, one in New York at Photoville, which is a photo festival in New York, and another one at the Month of Photography in Los Angeles, where we do physical iterations of this digital archive. And the things that people are writing are spectacular. It's almost, for some people, like therapy. And the photographs are, one woman sent in a photograph of a feather on a floor, not a good photograph at all, and wrote how this photo, this feather, triggered this memory of her as a teenager, of her best friend who had died, and all their experiences together. And it was really this incredibly powerful writing. Another photograph is black and white photograph of a woman smiling in a fountain. It's from 1969. And the man writes, "Here I am meeting my wife for the first time. The last 50 years have been the most incredible times of my life," and how incredible that was. The oldest photograph in the archive is from 1950. And it's a photograph of a woman in post-war Germany with her family, packing her crates, being put into an army truck, and she's being sent to America as part of a program for widows. And her father had died, and her mother was sending her to America. And so she writes, "Here's a photograph. I was so happy about to go off on this adventure, and I had no idea what was to come," and things like that. And she left. She came to America, and the film followed her later, got lost, and so on. And then her daughter heard me talking on the radio about this project and remembered that there was some roll of film from the family and sent it in. And now all of a sudden the family had this visual representation of the beginning of their family, of the matriarch of the family coming. And the family was sort of broken apart all over the United States. And this photograph got them all back together, talking and basically recreating their family. Often people hadn't spoken to each other for years, and all of a sudden this photograph started this whole conversation. It's also all about the power of photography. And so this project is, I think, really quite incredible. So I encourage people to go to lostrollsamerica.com. There's information how to submit your work. And we will be starting a national tour next year. So we'll have the installation. It's produced by United Photos Industries. It's a retro camper complete with white picket fence and astroturf and pink flamingos to kind of evoke this idea of America. And the photographs are all exhibited inside and outside the camper. And one of the things that this exhibition shows, and which I think is incredibly important today, in a world where we're like, you're red, I'm blue, you're red, and we're very different. In actuality, when you look at the memories that people are sharing of childhood, of vacations, of holidays, of travel, you see that the American experience is much more alike than different. So we're going to have these conversations from community to community to basically have people talk and say, like, yeah, my Christmas is like that, or my Thanksgiving is like that. And people are like, yeah, me too. And how it crosses through race and gender and economic class. So I think that this project, which started out just sort of as like, hey, let me develop some roles in my film, has turned into something much bigger. And so we're very excited. And we're also excited that Photo Wings has now endowed us with a grant to create a curriculum for high schools. So this will also be offered to high schools next year, which will talk about the value of photography and how kids can learn from it and all the different kind of aspects that are connected to the Lost Rolls America project. So we're going to kind of be hitting from all sides on this project.
That's wonderful. And that is funded through your foundation, which is, could you share with us the mission then of the foundation?
So the Seven Foundation, which was created as a complement to the Seven Photo Agency, is a non-for-profit. And our goal is to create projects that are not able to be funded by traditional media sources and so on. And in order, with a very big emphasis on education, using photography as an educational tool, we'll also be opening up a visual journalism academy in France next year. We are sponsoring workshops around the world. So you can also go to the sevenfoundation.org to learn all about the different things we're doing at the foundation.
Very noble. Thank you for sharing that, Ron. I checked your recent Facebook and Instagram posts, and what you were calling your Mexico walkabout, I noticed recently. There are photos of over 600 asylum seekers in Tijuana now. What do you think will make the big greatest impact on the awareness and then change for U.S. immigration policies in this regard in America happening right now?
Well, I think, you know, having just come back from the border, I think that, like many things, photography has the ability to take statistics and put a human face on them. So there's 6,000 people that are part of this caravan. There's another caravan coming. I'm going next week to Greece to work on a project with UNICEF to see what's happened to the refugees that were coming across 2 years ago. There are thousands of refugees still in camps in Greece. And we don't hear about these things anymore. We just see numbers. And you just think like, oh, it's out of the news. It's not happening anymore. Or I can't really comprehend what 100,000 refugees looks like. But when you see imagery and you connect a face to a story and understand that if they're not like you, they're like your parents or your grandparents or people that, you know, came to this country in a very similar way, it just hopefully we can look at things a little bit differently. I'm not out here to say what the right policy is, but I think it's important that we can't look at human beings as numbers, and we have to look at this as real lives.
And what is next for you personally? And quick question about the lost role yourself. Did you find an individual story that is part of the archive now too from your own collection of lost roles?
I think probably one of the most powerful pictures that I found was of a friend of mine, a colleague, another photographer who's also the founder of Seven, a woman named Alexandra Boulat, who passed away a number of years ago. And all of a sudden, this photograph popped up on the screen of her smiling at a wedding that we were at. And it was one of these amazing things, again, about the power of photography and why this Lost Roles project is so important, because these memories are locked away. And I didn't remember taking this photograph. And so it was this incredibly bittersweet experience of, I was so happy to see her again, but of course sad going through again, you know, losing her as a great friend, but also, you know, the beauty that came through in that photograph. And I think that, you know, it's why we take photographs. You know, we have these, we're constantly capturing these little memories of our lives.
Ron Haviv, thank you so much for joining us. Ron Haviv is the co-founder of the photo agency Seven, as well as the Seven Foundation, and has been producing images of conflict and humanitarian crises since the end of the Cold War. You can find links to his works on our website at wpsu.org/take note. For Take Note, I'm Carolyn Donaldson, WPSU.